Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, there is an article recently on Bloomberg, Bloomberg.com terminal, by Rachel Evans that sort of broke the terminal. That's one of the things we like to say when it gets really high readership. And it was about Spy.
Yeah, I know an article's big when a lot of people forward it to me and say, did you see this? Did you see this? And that happened with this article. It was all over Twitter. People could not believe it. And honestly, I didn't know about it specifically. I knew Spy was a unit investment trust, but I didn't know this detail and about these kids that were tied to it. And I thought it was fascinating.
So to break this down, we brought Rachel in as well as some of the Spy kids. Rachel, how did you find out about the story and what is it all about?
Well, as Eric pointed out, like, this is something that blew up on Twitter, and that's actually where we first came across this. Someone posted on Twitter last week, or I guess 2 weeks ago when this goes out, that they found this like weird kind of sentence in the documentation for Spy about how it had a set termination date, which is not usual in exchange-traded funds, and B, that the fund would either end at this termination date or when the last of 11 people named in the documentation died. So I got sent this email from a colleague of mine out in Hong Kong saying, this is the most fun ETF story ever. And I kind of agree.
And Spy, for those who don't know, this is the biggest ETF out there. Eric, you talk about it all the time because of how much it trades.
Yeah, just to drop some figures on Spy, it is the most traded equity, right? There's 4,000 to 6,000 stocks that are trading every day. Spy trades about $20 billion a day. That's about 3 or 4 times more than the next most, which would be Amazon or Apple, depending on the day. So in my opinion, SPY has become somewhat of a sun that a lot of the market revolves around. There's options. The options activities on SPY is massive. The trading in it is massive. People use it for liquidity. They use it for long-term investing. And what's interesting is it's probably the product that has the most diversified group of investors, from traders to hedge funds, to institutional investors. It's got 20% foreign investors. Everybody is in this.
And unlike other S&P 500 ETFs, this one, like we mentioned, is a trust. So the structure is a little bit different, and that's ultimately where the Spy Kids come in.
Yeah, so a UIT was basically chosen as the structure for the first ETF. We had, you know, after the 1987 exchange crash, we had a lot of people at the American Stock Exchange looking for a way to make a tradable product like SPY ended up being. And to do so, they started looking at what structure might work best and settled on a unit investment trust because it trades a bit like it can be used to trade a bit like a stock, but it also has that kind of investment side of things. But one of the issues with a UIT is that they have to have, or at the time, had to have a set termination date to deal with the rule against perpetuities.
And let me add a little more to this because when you're talking about ETFs, the regulatory structure is a field we have on Bloomberg to identify what kind of structure, because there's different things that go along with it. UITs, which there's a handful, maybe half a dozen ETFs that are structured as UITs, but they have 10% of the assets or $360 billion. SPY, the Qs, DIA, MDY are the big popular ones. And a couple things, not just the termination date, which we'll get into heavily in a minute, but they can't invest dividends back every day. They can only invest them quarterly. So there's a little tiny bit of cash drag in a UIT, although that can help if it's going down because you don't want to invest back into the market. The other thing is they can't do securities lending. Other ETFs, which are open-end funds, can lend securities. That isn't a huge deal in large cap stocks, but that can add a little extra revenue. So all told, SPY is actually the worst performing of the S&P 500 ETFs because of those reasons and because its fee is a little higher. So a lot of sometimes long-term investors will choose IVV or VU over SPY for those reasons. But the liquidity is so paramount that most people, all that doesn't matter. They're just going after that liquidity.
And one of the things that Rachel discovered about this was that that trust was actually set to expire in 2018. But one of the things that happened was that it was extended because of the trust being able to attach itself to individuals.
Yeah, so this was kind of like this weird quirk that we kind of came across. Initially, the trust was set up for 25 years. So 25 years from 1993, that puts you at last year. So we could have seen the SPY maturing or terminating at that point. However, when it became apparent that this was going to be more than just a sort of, you know, flash in the pan kind of success, that they worked to extend the trust and they extended it 100 years. And then to give it a bit of extra juice, they added the names of these 11 individuals. Charles, and stated that the fund would survive to 20 years beyond the last of their deaths, potentially giving it a little bit of extra extension.
No pressure, guys. That's where this week's episode comes in. This time on Trillions, Spy Kids. So joining us this time, we've got Paul Pavelka, Kevin McGrath, and Alexander Most. Alexander Most is actually the grandson of Nathan Most, who actually co-invented Spy in the first place. Guys, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
So trace to us, we'll start with Kevin. What person, what adult, when you were a baby, put your name in here?
Sure. It's my mom, Claire McGrath. She worked for Amex as a counsel at the time. She was a lawyer. And maybe it's best if I go back to how this kind of all started last Thursday. I was reached out to by a reporter via LinkedIn who contacted me and asked me if my name was Kevin Patrick McGrath, which is strange because I don't really use my middle name in any type of dot. Like, I think it's maybe only on my passport. And he laid out this whole thing. Did you have a family member who was in finance? You know, you're connected to this very large fund. To me, I'm reading this as a, you know, this is like a very elaborate scam, Nigerian prince scam. It's like, wow, this is, you guys are really getting into that. So I was like, okay, send me the copy of the filing. I want to see it. Not thinking this would turn into anything. Not only he sends me the filing link, but he sends an attachment with our names. And it's my name, his name, cousin Paul, and our cousin Pete. So now then, like I was like, whoa, this is weird. And another thing that triggered it for me just scrolling through the filing was Spider. I recognized the name Spider. I went visiting my mom's office as a kid. There was a lot of, you know, the one thing every kid does is go to the swag room. And I remember seeing the Spider logo. And, you know, 8 to 10-year-old boy, it's like, oh, wow, cool, Spider.
My mom has the coolest job
in
the world.
I know, exactly. Yeah, like, awesome. That definitely lit a bell. I knew it had to be related to something she did. My concern is like, did she get me something involved in sketchy, or is this like, I assume it was normal. You know, my mom wouldn't do that. And yeah, it was just kind of off from there. It was pretty wild. Rachel contacted us. I spoke to her, and it's just been a very surreal week.
So, Paul, what memories of Spy do you have? Because you and Kevin actually have known each other outside of the Spy Kid relationship, right?
Yes, that's right. We grew up together. My dad is originally from Long Island, so for holidays and in the summer, we would, as a family, go and visit Kevin and his mom and dad. And so as far as Spider goes, this was all completely new to me as of last Thursday. Kevin reached out to me as I'm getting ready for work. I work in Philadelphia. I am a bartender. And all of a sudden, I get a text message from Kevin who goes, are reporters trying to reach out to you? Now, you know, I'm sitting on the bus on my way to work. And like, why? Why are reporters reaching out? Like, you know, there's like a certain panic that sets in.
What did I do?
Exactly. Why is my cousin that lives in New York asking me and my brother if we're hearing from reporters? Okay. It's just like a fair amount for a regular Joe Schmo person. There's like a fair amount of like horror that goes into that. What went viral this time, you know? And come to find out, I spoke with Rachel as well, you know, standing in an alleyway waiting to, you know, go into work. And I'm on the phone with her and she explains how all of this happened. And between Kevin sort of giving me a heads up that, hey, there's this reporter from Bloomberg that's going to reach out to you, and actually speaking to her properly is how I've been brought up to speed, if you want to even call it that. This is still pretty much, the intro is a little over my head it's still at this point.
That's all Alexander's fault, actually. Right? Or maybe Alexander, maybe it was your grandfather's fault. What memories of Nathan Most do you have, Alexander?
Yeah, so, you know, I remember Nathan Most pretty well. He passed away when I was younger, but he was always, you know, a large figure, patriarch in my family, someone who lived a couple towns away from me in California, but I really didn't know much about his history and involvement in the finance world and the history of ETFs, really until last Thursday when I got a lot more context and learned a lot more about it.
Do you even remember him telling you stories about the ETF or him being the godfather of the ETF or anything like that?
Not a single thing about that, to be honest. Generally, our conversations revolved around what was for dinner that night.
Okay. This is like old school Godfather. You don't discuss business at the dinner table, Joe. Right. Come on.
I should have known better, yeah.
I also spoke with Alexander's father and uncle about their memories of Nate for the story. I was pretty much tracking down everybody's immediate family and having a conversation. So that was kind of like great just to get some real color about what they remember about, you know, Nathan at that time and visiting the American Stock Exchange and hearing about his work. So I think, you know, it's given us all a lot more history about actually how Spy kind of came into being than maybe we knew this time last week.
And so there was 11 of them. Was there like an email? Like, not, I guess it was 93. Were they sending an email? Maybe they actually had a memo back in the day. Whatever. Did they get did the word get around the office that
courier.
We need, that we need like baby names? And can you just talk about how that? How the 11 got chosen?
Yeah, so I mean, I had a hunch when I was trying to figure out who the 11 were that maybe they were connected to the American Stock Exchange, and that proved to be largely correct. My understanding is basically they just put out a call for baby names. I'm not sure whether that was done by email or carrier pigeon or what, but Claire spoke to me, Kevin's mom spoke to me about how she remembers hearing people just asking for names of younger relatives that they could put in this trust. You know, obviously, the parents kind of were involved in the Amex, many of them directly with that. She's setting up the ETF. So they were relatively comfortable with their kids' names being used. You've got to remember, this is a pretty arcane legal document. And to your point about email, you know, the internet hadn't really begun doing its thing in the early 90s. So the likelihood that this their names would ever come to light from this, you know, they're going to be buried in a document in the SEC's vaults. They kind of came forward with these names. You know, we had communications people like giving their step-grandkids. We had, sort of some of the specialists at the time that were going to be trading that ETF, giving their daughter. So yeah, it's a very odd thing, but that's how it kind of came about.
And why 11?
That's a great question. I have absolutely no idea. I think they wanted to move. If you have one, obviously that's a bit risky.
So
I
mean, diversification.
I don't know whether any of the Spy kids know this, but my kind of sense is that it was just a large enough group whereby you're not putting all of that pressure on one person to stay alive.
Did you guys look at the other 11 names? Mm-hmm. How many do you guys know?
I don't know any of them, but my mom.
Just
Paul. I mean, yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, Alexander,
my you guys... younger brother is also one of the 11, but he works for the water department, so he didn't get off today. Unfortunately, he's not a bartender like me.
So, Alexander, how many names did you know?
Absolutely none at all. To be honest, I'm surprised that anyone knew anyone at all. It's cousins right here.
Yeah. I think part of it was also, I don't know why the number, but I think part of why my cousins and I were chosen because I think they wanted some geographical diversity as well. That's like another big thing. But a lot of the people were names my mom recognized. Weber, I think who you spoke, Claire Weber, is Cliff Weber's daughter. He was a big part of this.
Rachel, I have a question for you. How did you track them down? I'm just curious. I'm not sure if you can unveil your methods, but was it like Google to LinkedIn to...
All of that, okay. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like rule 101 of a reporter is just be dogged and keep looking. So, I mean, given we had a list of full names, had a list of some addresses, list of dates of birth, really Google and then just hitting the phones. You can't beat a good bit of sort of old-fashioned footwork in trying to track people down.
Did you reach out to anybody who was like... No comment. Stay away from me.
Kevin alluded to thinking that this was a scam when he was first reached out to on LinkedIn. And I definitely spoke with a couple of other people directly who were like, Yeah, my work says you're trying to fish me. So there were a few people that were very suspicious of this and completely understandably so. I mean, it's not every day you get a call completely out of the blue where somebody has your full name, your address, your relationships with various people. I can totally understand how it would freak anybody out. And trying to reassure people that I wasn't there to fish them. I just had this like really odd story about how they were connected to a $250 billion fund, which again sounds very scammy, was a little bit of a challenge.
How would you like to make $250 billion?
Yeah. It's Rachel, the Nigerian Princess Evans.
I do have a question for Rachel, actually. So you're the one who did like a lot of the research on this. We're 11 individuals. We are named in this document. Is there, in your research, is there somebody... keeping track of us? I mean, Aunt Claire said that she didn't give them like our social security numbers. My parents don't remember giving my aunt our social security numbers to be attached to this document. So like, what if we change our names? What if we like decide to go underground? Like, how will that impact?
Yeah.
This?
Hit up Deedpoll, get that name changed.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
It's a great question. And we actually reached out to State Street that currently runs the fund to see if they had any comment on this or any color on what they were doing to keep tabs on things. And they referred comment to the New York Stock Exchange, which obviously bought the Amex, who declined to comment. So we don't know. I mean, it seems as though at the moment your names are out there, and I'm sure people are keeping a closer watch on you than maybe they were before.
There's some sort of room that has all of our pictures and heartbeats and what current locations, known aliases.
No, you should do that at the bar.
Well, I mean...
Yeah, no, I don't know if anyone's actually keeping a direct record. So, I mean, it seems like you guys are probably safe in that respect for now.
All right, very cool. Good. Good to know. I can sleep easy tonight.
So what if you wanted to get your name removed from this?
I am not sure. You would have to ask a unit investment trust lawyer. My understanding is that these things can be amended, so you could replace the list with other babies, but I'm not sure whether you could remove one name.
Right. I have some lawyer regulars that sit at the bar who will remain nameless. And after the first few like questions of, do you get the money? Are they going to put a hit on you? Like the next question that, of course, the lawyers asked is, how does this make you feel? Do you feel harmed by this? Is this causing emotional duress for you that reporters are coming out of the woodwork? And how does it feel that your
existence... We only charge $250 an hour.
Yeah. How do you feel that your existence is tied to this multi-billion dollar thing, right? So the question was like, well, can we maybe get some legal money out of this, some damages situation? And listen, if you bring a claim against whoever it would be that is like the person that the claim would be brought against, I mean, I'm obviously not suing Aunt Claire because I love my Christmas presents. if we try to bring suit, then they'll just amend us out. They'll just be like, all right, well, we're not going to give you damages. You're just not part of this anymore. And then me, I won't have the fun fact that Alexander and Kevin and I, Pete, all have. So
when you went to Aunt Claire, or your mom, your aunt, right?
Mom for him.
Did she have, I'm picturing a movie where they go, I knew this day would come. Like, did she sit you down and you know, explain, like, who you are, like, this special superpower you have?
Or... There's a book.
No, it was more, did I do that?
It was what now?
Yeah, you know, again, to go back to kind of Rachel's point that we were discussing a little bit earlier, these were, I think it's like a 60-plus page document that nobody was expecting. I mean, people don't read their iTunes terms and conditions nowadays. That's like actual legal things that they should care about. And like now somebody's fishing through the 60-page filing for this ETF. I mean, obviously it being the biggest ETF probably garnered that attention. But yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, she was totally like, I guess I must have.
So Alexander, when we talk to people in all of our conversations about exchange traded funds, Nathan Most is sort of viewed as basically the guy who, you know, created the thing. And so everything that we've seen ETFs do in finance and for investors basically goes back to your grandfather. Eric, when you kind of think about the impact that that's had in finance, like, what, you know, put it in context for us.
I can't understate it. I think, you know, besides Vanguard and John Bogle and introducing index funds and the mutual ownership structure, this is right up there in terms of things that have affected the financial markets in the last 50 years. Nathan Most, who I researched a lot, I talked with your grandfather's colleague named Steve Bloom when I was researching a book. He's hard to reach. He's like Professor Faulkner from War Games. You can find him, but it's hard. And I did get him on a call for an hour, and he spoke very highly.
That was a good War Games reference.
Thank you. It's totally appropriate. And just so you know, this was a big deal. Him and your grandfather were in an office in the American Stock Exchange, which was in third place, right? So it was kind of a story of the down-and-out exchange looking for an idea, and they found it in SPY, and your grandfather and Steve developed this product. And it took a while, but now ETFs take in, you know, the majority of all new flows that in America. I mean, this is a big deal. Half of the top 30 biggest asset managers have ETFs, and a lot of people are using them because they're cheap, tax efficient, yada yada. I equate them to the MP3. I think what he did was similar to what the MP3 did to music. So, what do you think of that?
You know, I think it's really interesting, especially because I myself, the few investments I have are invested in ETFs, and it seems like that's really democratized investing and made accessible to just average people outside of actual managers. So it's a fascinating piece of history and kind of interesting to see where it's evolved.
Can you give us any of the ETFs you own? I'm just curious.
I actually am invested in VOO.
Oh, that's too funny. Oh. That is awesome.
But, by the way, okay, I have to say. So if you Google Nate Most, John Bogle, your grandfather went to see Bogle to try to get the Vanguard 500 to be the first ETF. And Bogle told him, no way, I don't want trading anywhere near my ETF. But apparently Bogle says he gave him some ideas. So long story short, there's a lot of history in your VOO.
That is so ironic. Okay, so Paul, you're a bartender, 20-something.
Sure.
Knew nothing about ETFs before this article published. How is this going to change your life?
Well, for the record, I'm the oldest member of the SPY group, so the de facto patriarch, in my opinion. So, you know, I've been telling my bar guests about this, right? Because, you know, when you sit at a bar, it's dinner and a show. And the first question that they ask is, am I going to get any money out of this? And, you know, they're disappointed to hear, no, I'm not. But
How do you get into that? Is it like a little trivia about myself?
Oh, it's actually ridiculously difficult to explain to anybody. Like, hey, read this article that my name is in, like, four
paragraphs.
Yeah, yeah. And they're like, and it's like 20 minutes later, they're done their drink. There's tickets printing in the back that I'm just ignoring because I'm trying to explain this to my bar guests. And most of the time, they still don't get it. So the question that I get asked after that is, well, do they want to kill you to make the trust mature? And that was, you know, that was my second question. Like, is Rachel putting me on a hit list right now? Is this happening? And I mean, you're the financial experts. I'm safe, I hope, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
you're good.
There are some desperate active mutual funds out there, but I don't think they go that far.
Yeah, it's funny. I got a number of pitches for potential thrillers based on the SPY kits. How they're all bumped off secretly over a period of time and what happens to this $250 billion fund. But no, rest assured, it's 20 years after the death of the last person, definitely enough time for the managers of the fund to sort it out, making bumping you guys off very, very unnecessary indeed.
Right. If somebody wants to make money from this trust, they can just sell their shares.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, don't please keep that in mind. Would be hit people.
So what actually does happen when this, you know, expiration date gets hit in 2118?
So we will see the termination of SPY if we get to that point. However, the lawyers that I have spoken to since have emphasized the fact that the rule of perpetuities has now been taken off the books in New York. So there is the potential to just amend SPY again and extend the termination date out further or remove the termination date altogether. Potentially, you could have another group of babies put in to give it that lifespan aspect, but you don't need to, given that the rule of perpetuities has ended. So you could have a new fund set up to gradually take the assets. You could have another amendment, but ultimately it seems like SPY or equivalent is not going anywhere.
So Kevin, how did this article, you work in finance a little bit, you're in PR, how did this article change things for you?
Well, I just kind of learned a lot. That's probably the most interesting thing. I mean, I knew what my mom did. I always was kind of just being tangentially, you hear talk over the dinner table, you know, that type of thing. But it was just interesting to hear really like the story of how this, you know, why they chose the Unitary Investment Trust. You know, it was really because at the time they had to push this through the SEC and they actually had to get two divisions of the SEC to work on this. So they wanted to keep it as simple as possible and they had to basically take a known vehicle for this investment. And that's how they basically settled on this Unitary Investment Trust. And that's why they had to put our names in. And that's, you know, again, the rule of perpetuities, like you were saying before. I mean, I think that's really the fascinating story of just persistence in, like, creating this new vehicle for investment. Maybe a Michael Lewis book.
For me, it always speaks to the fact that, you know, behind all of the finance industry, there are people, right? Yeah. And, like, you know, we've interviewed a lot of people who were around the creation of it. And there was so much pride in it because people were just like, hey, we can create something new. I think finance sometimes gets a bad rap, rightfully so. But the other side of it is a lot of people have made a lot of money thanks to the innovations that have come through this. And those are rooted in people and ideas. Alexander, how do you think this article will change things for you?
Well, I have the greatest fun fact of all time now. But besides that, I really just wonder, you know, we talked about the potential intrigue around us being assassinated or something. I think that the people in the financial industry should pay to keep me healthy so this stays around.
I second that.
the investor should, that's for sure. And Alexander, did anybody from your family say anything or have any reaction?
I mean, so it was actually my mom first got the phone call at our family office, and then she's the one who contacted me with the ridiculous $250 billion number, which we've many times mentioned seemed like a scam. Everyone saw it's pretty cool and been talking about it. I've been reached out to plenty of times, and we all want some sort of money out of it, so it doesn't look like
Amen,
it's going to happen.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, I spoke with a lot of the parents here. I spoke with Claire and with her husband, George, and they were both kind of like, oh, I vaguely remember something like this, but I didn't expect it to be, come back to me, you know, 25 years later.
What they should have done is given you a couple shares of SPY. Want to guess how much it is up since 1993? A cool 1,000%. Yeah, so $10 would be whatever. Joel, you tell me the math on that.
You know, a few more than it was then. All right, Alexander, Paul, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions. Rachel, the Nigerian princess, as always, well done.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
If you're interested in learning more about the creation of SPY, Eric and I actually have a special season of Trillions called The ETF Story that you can find on Bloomberg or iTunes or wherever else you listen to podcasts. And you'll get to hear from the very people around the creation of SPY and how it came into being. Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can find Rachel at RachelEvans_NY. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcast. Bye.